Today on the show, I'm speaking to Britt Klontz. Britt is a freelance digital PR and content marketing consultant and trainer. She is also the former head of digital PR at Distilled, where Britt and I worked together on a number of successful campaigns, some of which even went viral. And Britt is also now the co-host of the We Earn Media podcast, where she interviews PRs and journalists and content creators to get different perspectives on creating and promoting stories to journalists. During the show, Britt and I really go into almost every aspect of promoting content and stories to journalists. We start with what makes an idea newsworthy and how to get top-tier coverage for useful content and guides, something which is sometimes a little bit challenging. How to make sure you get headlines out of your survey questions. I'm sure some of us have been in the situation where we've created a survey and then been scratching our head at it, trying to figure out where the key stories are. So Britt reveals how to avoid that in the first place. We look at the full package of assets to provide to journalists, when Britt sends the full press release to journalists and when she doesn't, numerous ways to offer value in your follow-up emails, and what Britt has learned from interviewing lots of PRs and journalists in the We Earn Media podcast. So we really do cover a lot of ground and go into quite a bit of detail in each. The level of insight Britt was able to share was great, and it was a very enjoyable conversation and lovely to catch up with her again. As always, there are show notes over at contenthubble.com/podcast, where you'll find lots of links and images and further information, which will give you additional context to help you appreciate what we're talking about in the show. All right, that's more than enough from me. Let's get on with the show. All right, well, let's get rolling. Hello, Britt.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me. It's nice to see a friendly face.
Yeah, you too. I had a bit of an idea of how we might take this today. So maybe go a bit. I get asked a lot of questions in my workshops about PR, and I kind of know a bit about PR, but realistically, when it comes to the outreach side of things, I'm not a specialist. That's not really what I've done. But obviously, I try to make sure the stuff that we create is outreachable. But it'd be quite interesting to maybe dig into a lot of the common questions I get asked in workshops about PR and see what you can provide on that side of things.
Cool. Sounds good.
And of course, we can just see where it goes. I thought maybe one place to start would be the idea side of things. When you're presented with an idea, whether that's come from your team or maybe there's a separate creative team, what do you look for to think about whether this is going to be something you can promote?
I should have prepared better for this question because I figured you were going to start with it. So, because I remember when we would work together at Distilled, what I appreciated most about our partnership and how the creative team and the PR team worked together was that we were pulled into the brainstorm immediately. And we both added our own ideas, both from the creative team's perspective and the PR team's perspective. And then we fed back on one another's. And that really helped me better understand how I can come up with more data-driven ideas, what sort of data sources to look at, and how they might be able to be visualized as well. The formatting bit was not necessarily my forte, you know, thinking about what's the format going to be and how can we convey the story in a visually appealing way. So when I look at just thinking about that time that we had at Distilled and when I'm thinking of ideas for my clients today, what I look for are a few things. I try to put my journalist hat on, of course, if the goal is to pitch this piece. And from there, I look at A, relevance. And James and Olivia in episode 3, I believe, talked about this as well. I think it's really important to make sure that the idea fits for the client, the brand. And of course, you don't want it to be uber promotional, but you want to make sure that it makes sense that they're talking on this subject in some way, shape, or form. It can't be too unrelated. I also then think about what is the story that we're trying to tell? Is it timely? Right now, in today's world, that can go a long way. it's really easy to get lost in today's news cycle. You're pitched to get lost. Journalists are working under intense deadlines, and it's even more important for them to create timely news stories. I think about the timeliness a lot. How does it speak to what people want to read these days? A lot of people are very eager to read happy news, right? But a lot of people are eager to see useful information. And that goes into my ideation as well.
What do you mean by useful information?
I guess I can share an example. One of my clients, they create promotional marketing material products. So they'll help you, any kind of company at all, put their logo on any sort of item. They have a variety of items that they sell, whether it's coffee mugs, or when the pandemic started, they pivoted to creating face masks, creating those stickers that we see everywhere now, telling us to stay 6 feet apart. Companies were snagging those to put their logos on and whatnot. So we had to come up with an idea. And one way that we made this piece relevant to journalists who might be who we were targeting was to come up with an idea that we basically put out a survey where we asked people who have been out of the workplace and working remotely, what would it take to get them to return to the workplace? What would make them feel safe in order to do so? What can their employers and the companies who are buying these products from my client, what can they do? And what should they be doing to get their employees to return to the workplace safely? So basically, we asked some questions like temperature checks, would that make them feel better? How often? And of course, how far apart they should be? Should it be like a situation where groups of people come in at a time and they shift between coming into the office and not coming into the office? Stuff like that. And from there, we put together this beautiful guide for employers to reference when they're planning that return. Now I'm just going into why I also really like this piece or what we did to make it more credible. But one thing that I was totally aware of was that why is this promotional marketing product company creating this piece for employers? It's very HR focused. It's something that you would probably respect more coming from an HR company. So what we did was I put my journalist hat on. I used Haro, Help a Reporter Out, to basically find HR experts to give us commentary and suggestions on what they were doing to help their employees return to the workplace safely. And gosh, did I get a lot of responses. Now I know what journalists, how they feel when they have to like trudge through all of these different emails and figure out who is the best expert. But it paid off. We found an HR consultant who works for an agency of HR folks who are contracted to come and work for different companies to provide HR advice. We used some of his commentary, which was beautiful, smart advice. And then when we went to pitch the piece, I actually pitched the piece, you know, our survey insights to the reporters. But to give it that extra layer of credibility, I used his credibility and pitched commentary from, his name was Eric. I pitched his commentary to the journalists and reporters, and I offered his time up for them to interview him. And that way, when the reporters did, they referenced our survey insights throughout the story, gave credit to my client, but they also referenced an expert's advice. So I think that's a good example of what I think about when I'm trying to figure out what's a good story. What's relevant? How can we provide a timely news hook? But also, how can we appear credible too?
Nice. Yeah, the way you use commentary there, is it fair to say that you spotted perhaps a small gap in the relevance and the credibility, and you use the commentary to bridge that? Is that what you, oh, your bearded dragon just jumped in the background.
He's eating his bok choy.
That's okay. Hilarious. Yeah. Obviously, this is an audio-only podcast, but if you could see what I could see right now, there's a bearded dragon wandering about in a tank, and it just kind of leapt to life. We may or may not keep that in. Well, how I interpreted what you said there is you spotted a gap, perhaps, in the relevance and the credibility that maybe the journalists would question, that made the thing not all fit together quite perfectly. And so you used commentary from experts to bridge that gap. Is that a reasonable way of thinking of that?
Yeah, I think it is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you actually put the request out on Harrow rather than the opposite way around for once. And that worked out well.
Yeah, it did. It worked out really well. I use it often to just bolster or create better content on behalf of my clients, especially if they don't necessarily have the credentials, like Dr. Wood or like, I don't know, somebody with a PhD might, to speak on a certain topic, if that makes sense.
This is strange, but I hadn't thought of using Harrow that way around. I assume we would just need to research and find an expert to comment. But I guess this way, everybody's kind of putting their hands up as wanting to be part of the story. And that I like it when, you know, it can feel like win-win-win. Like the journalist gets a story that hopefully gets a bit of attention on their site, the client gets the recognition they want, and then your expert gets recognition.
Right.
It took me a long time to think like that. I always thought about what we can get. You know, like begging the journalist to cover our stuff and get our links. But when you start to think of it the other way, it's sort of a nicer way to approach it.
Right. And I think it looks good in the eyes of Google as well, because you're incorporating expertise into your contents.
The commentary can make it a little more human, you know, because they can add a layer of interpretation and what this means beyond just data.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I questioned the useful bit is because I've seen people wanting to do like how-to content, you know, and hoping it will get lots of links. And I think there was a time back in the day that worked, but I think it's pretty hard now to get the sort of bigger links and coverage for a piece of how-to. But I think the difference there is you did the survey, you gathered information that wasn't available.
Right.
Whereas how-to content is usually just information that's already available. And so it's hard to pitch that as a story of any kind of anything of substance. Also guides, you know, you make an interesting point there. People often pick guide as a format, but I often notice that they don't have a clear angle in it. They almost do the same as the how-to. Let's just gather a bunch of information that already exists and now it's a guide.
Mm-hmm.
You actually clearly had new insights, new information, and a clear angle within your guide. That's a distinction I think a lot of people miss when they're making that kind of useful content sometimes.
Yes, I think that's key, and you hit the nail on the head there. It's like if you're going to provide useful content and you're expecting to get top tier coverage, make sure that you're presenting new information, whether that's data that you've pulled together from a complicated data source that somebody hasn't simplified yet. That's okay. You know, it's published publicly already, but you're presenting it in a way that's useful. Or maybe it's proprietary data from the company's internal data or internal information. If you're able to use that, amazing. I'm so jealous when people are able to do that. Not many of my clients are. And also, if you're able to like do a survey the right way, that's another way to get that information and present something new and useful.
Oh, that's a question. Doing a survey the right way. What does that involve?
It's a loaded topic, and it's a question that we like to ask a lot of reporters ourselves on the We Earn Media podcast. I'm totally not trying to do a plug, but...
By all means, everyone should listen to your podcast. It's good.
It's a question that I always ask myself too when I'm putting together surveys. I, again, put my journalist hat on and think, is this data sound, and what kind of holes can I poke in it? And questions I ask is... If it's a very niche survey, like say we're asking, for example, the campaign that I just referenced about returning to the workplace, we made sure to incorporate screening questions to guarantee that we're surveying people who are in that situation and they're not just taking the survey to get paid. I don't know if I can throw out a company that I recommend, but...
Can, as far as I'm concerned, yeah.
Okay. CensusWide are a great survey company to work with. I think that came from my time at Distilled, just the partnership that I have with somebody there I still work with today, and he's great. I think they're a bit expensive though. So if you don't have that kind of budget, SurveyMonkey is also a good one, and Polefish, as long as, again, you're incorporating those screening questions to make sure that you're targeting the right audience. And of course, if you're going to go to a journalist with this data, make sure that you've gathered enough respondents before putting together anything. And usually the minimum is 1,000 respondents. And if you're presenting information on a very niche topic, you can dwindle it down a bit because it's a smaller sample size of folks. But if it's a national piece, you want that respondent count to be at least 1,000. And the more the merrier. It just depends on your budget, and it can get kind of pricey.
What's a good screening question, or what did you use in this occasion to make sure you're speaking to the right people?
In this occasion, because I wanted only people who were working in the office pre-pandemic and now we're working remotely and hadn't returned yet, the first question they got was like around that. So were you working in an office pre-pandemic? Yes. Then they'd move on to, are you now working remote? Yes. Then they'd move on to the questions regarding what would get them to return to the workplace. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Does the screening question make it more expensive?
Yes, but there are ways to work around it. If you have a genius data analyst, you can go through the data and disqualify any of those people who technically shouldn't be answering questions related to returning to the workplace if they are back at the workplace, as an example, or if they've never left the workplace. So you could pay for all of those responses, which is technically cheaper, and then disqualify them. But then you run into the problem of not having enough valid responses.
Yeah, I guess you could weigh up the cost of the screening versus how many more people you're going to have to interview in the first place. So it maybe works out similar.
Mm-hmm.
I think some specific screening questions can make it very expensive, but because that's if you're looking for a very small number of people, because it's kind of time consuming for them to find it. But just curious. Yeah, one thing I find with surveys is sometimes I've heard people kind of say, they'll show me the questions they want to ask. And then I said, but what stories are you hoping to get out of this?
Mm.
And they'll say to me, we'll figure that out when we get the data.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no. You have to have an idea up front. Otherwise, I've seen it as well. It comes back and like, there's nothing here. You didn't ask anything.
Yeah.
Is there anything you do to make sure your questions have a good chance of generating a story? How do you think about that part?
Yeah. So for every question that we write, I make sure that there's a headline that we hope to get out of it. And we just leave the percentages, you know, we guesstimate, but we have multiple headlines for each question that we hope to get out of it. And if there's no headline for that question, we nix it.
That's so simple, but that's actually brilliant. That is great.
SurveyMonkey, it's very manual and lots of human error occurs, especially like I am not by any means an expert on surveys, and it's hard. I'm nervous to talk about it on the show, to be honest, because I still mess up.
We won't go any deeper than this, I promise.
But these are just my opinions. This is what I've learned. And with SurveyMonkey, there's a lot of like human error that could happen because, you know, you're launching it yourself.
And one thing I have done previously, again, I don't do it religiously every time, but you said you write some headlines for each question. As a final sense check, I might do some Googling around that.
Mm-hmm.
Just put that headline into Google or something like it to find out, is that the type of things people will write? Maybe that's going a step too far. But if I'm not sure about it, if I can't quite picture it in a publication, I might just do some searching to see if that is the type of thing they would say.
I do the same, especially when I need some inspiration.
Nice. So you mentioned, you know, we worked together at Distilled and we had a separate creative and outreach team, and that can come with some challenges sometimes. When have you seen that working well? And then when have you seen maybe some challenges crop up? Like I can think of one immediately that sometimes we used to forget to show the content to the PRs until they had to promote it, which was ridiculous. And that used to happen more times than it should have, because we didn't have at the time an inbuilt check to make sure everybody had seen this at the right times. And we did develop that, but I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on, I don't necessarily mean a specific time, but just what does it look like when that works well and maybe when it becomes more challenging?
Exactly. That was going to be the first response that I had to that, was to make sure that you're involving the teams, everybody's collaborating from the get-go, because then it's all about pointing fingers. If something goes wrong and the PR team had never seen the content until the day it launched, it's easy for PRs to say, well, to, you know, point to that and be like, well, this is the mistake. And nobody wants that to happen. So the way that it works best is to, when you've got a client, and this is speaking from an agency side, I guess it can apply to in-house as well, though. When you're thinking of new campaign ideas, brainstorm together. People have different opinions, but I like to have a Google Doc where everybody can incorporate their ideas into one place and then build upon one another's ideas. This sounds really basic and simple, but that's what I always recommend, is collaborating together, because you never know when you might be able to chime in. And whether it's from like a PR perspective or whether it's an idea to make that piece really shine during the production phase, it kind of lends to better brainstorming and a better end result. Simple answer. Just getting everybody to collaborate from the get-go is always best.
Yeah, absolutely. I always encourage people to share more of their ideas rather than less, because like you say, you never know what someone else might see in it that you didn't. In the workshops I run, I get people to share their ideas with each other and people will feedback to them which ones they like. And they're very frequently surprised about the ones that resonate with people and the ones that don't. We're so often just a poor judge of our own ideas. It's just interesting to see what happens when you put them in front of people and how that expands.
Yeah.
Speaking about things that can be surprising, I'm often asked this question, what pieces of content have I been surprised by that I've worked on that either was more successful than I thought it might have been, or the opposite, where you thought it was going to be really successful and then it wasn't quite, and I guess what you learned from that. But you can answer that in either way. But is there any way that you think about that kind of surprised you when you look back and see what happened?
So usually I'm very surprised when we embark on an idea that covers a topic that people gripe about all the time. I feel like adding to that noise sometimes can be bad and like old news, right? For example, commuting. Back when we used to have to do that, this was, I don't know, back in 2017 or 18 probably. And we had a client who was in the Fleetmatic software space. So basically they track semi-trucks with various data, like with their trackers and stuff. I'm terrible at explaining what they do, but I can't say who they are. So that's helpful in that respect. But basically we created this beautiful data viz and it was all about commuting. And we conducted a study to determine the cities with the worst commute times via car and public transit. And to do this, the researchers who compiled all this data that I cannot take credit for, they took the commute times for, I think it was like the 20 largest cities in the US, and they used data from the 2016 American Community Survey from the Census Transportation Planning Products Program. It's a mouthful.
Good job remembering that.
So they took that data, publicly available, right? And it was a few years old as well. And like I said, I think this came out in 2017 or 18. So it wasn't necessarily fresh, but they don't update it every year. So it was still technically new, right? But I had my hesitations. Like, this is such, I don't think anybody is going to really want to talk about this because I already hate my commute and I just don't want to know more about how much commute times suck all over the US, let alone in my city. But we moved forward with it. The data piece, I mean, the actual campaign was gorgeous and very intricate. And I think I keep referencing this episode, but the episode you had with James and Olivia, you talked about how the best data visualizations take a ton of data and represent it in a very easy to understand way. I don't think this piece did that at all. Mm-hmm. So I was really hesitant to promote it and to see what the results would be. So turns out people still love to bitch about their commute and see the data associated with it. And to be able to say something like, I live in a city that has the worst commute times, ha ha, like don't complain to me, resonates with people. Because what I ended up having to do was taking that localized data for each city and creating personalized pitches showcasing only that city's data, and even writing press releases, going back to the old traditional PR toolkit, right? Writing press releases that showcase only headlines associated with that city and only data points related to that city. So that way, we eventually started seeing local news outlets covering these pieces, and the headlines were like, Atlanta, yet again, named one of the worst places to commute. And here's how long it takes to get to work in New York City. One of them that was my favorite, I think it was on Curbs Boston when that was around. I don't think Curb exists anymore, which makes me really sad. They had a headline that was like, Boston's population increases along with housing costs and commute times. So it wasn't necessarily the most positive piece, but it had data to support a common complaint in that location. So there was newness, or like a new aspect to it, that gave reporters the opportunity to write about something that people complain about and back it up with data. So that was one campaign that surprised me.
Yeah, well, you've done well getting success on a piece on commuting, because I've definitely tried that, but it was not successful. Like you say, a lot of people do, because there's so many clients in the automotive space, and what do people do in their cars? They commute. Like, that's what we do most of the time. And so they usually want to talk about it, but it can be quite challenging to come up with something new that gets some cut through. So that's cool.
Yeah, I kind of miss commuting now.
A little bit, yeah. I listen to less stuff now. I have to go out for my daily walk to get a bit of a podcast in.
Another thing too with that, I think it's worth mentioning, since it speaks to what this podcast is all about as well. Like I said, this piece was very intricate, and it had, you know, you could click on the city and go look at the commuting map for that city. So we had Dropbox folders galore for each individual city that had all of the imagery for that city in a certain folder. So when I went to a reporter with it, I could say, like, here's where the piece lives, but here are all of the imagery that you would need to just showcase the data for your city. So they had this visual asset to incorporate into their article as well. And that way their readers didn't have to go to the piece itself, which can mean that you might get less traffic. But if your goal is to get a link or coverage in general, you're still meeting that main goal.
Yeah, it sounds like you said that the main piece was quite complex, or maybe wasn't as simple to understand as you might like. But I think, yeah, if you've given them a simple story, you said you'd given them the headline specific to their area, given them the imagery, then they can point towards this big thing as the source. But maybe even if it is a little bit complicated, you gave them the simple story, which is what they needed.
Exactly. Yeah, I made it simple for them. Another cool thing too is like just being able to go to them with imagery that isn't necessarily in the piece itself. So maybe they want to incorporate, you know, stock photos, photos of actual cars on the roads, and traffic photos. We had a folder just for that with proper crediting information as well.
This is really interesting, because I don't think about this side of it that much. So you went and found, was it royalty-free stock images?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And you download them and give them all the information they need to credit it properly. Is that it?
Yeah.
That's a great idea. And you said there was a commuter map. What did that show? Was that showing commuting times from different parts of the city?
So each individual city map had an average commute time. So just taking like Washington, D.C., for example, it has the average commute time of 41 minutes. It talks about how many commuters they see on the road each day and how many of those commuters are able to get to their workplace within a certain amount of time. So, for example, for Washington, D.C., only 29% of commuters are able to get to their work within 30 minutes. And then increased significantly from there. So 88% could get to their workplace within an hour. And then 12% of commuters took over 1 hour to get to their workplace.
There are some quite interesting stats. Like, I wouldn't have thought of necessarily reducing it that way. That builds up the picture a bit more rather than just saying the average commute is 44 minutes. You know, okay.
Mm-hmm. That was for commuters who traveled by car. You could also select commuters who travel by public transit and see that information as well and how it compares. So there's a lot of gems within, you know, certain cities. And if I were to go to a national press with this story, and which I tried, it didn't do nearly as well.
Yeah, fair enough. That makes sense. Actually, this kind of presents a nice lead-in. What are the things that you like to have set up when you're going to pitch a journalist a story? And I don't know if you do this every time, but you tailored headlines and stats to each target. You made sure you had the sort of visuals from the data piece. You made sure you had some other photos they might like to include. Like, what does the full package look like when you're going to promote something?
I try to always come up with like headlines before we even go into production so that I can start thinking about how I'm going to pitch the story and sort of start creating those pitches as well. I don't spend too much time on that, but I like to get an idea and then I know, okay, here's who I'm going to go after. Then I can start building my media list and I have an idea of what verticals I might target. Like if it's more of a national focused piece or is it more of a local story? When the piece is published, I like to have all of the additional imagery assets that I can get my hands on, whether it's high resolution imagery of the piece itself or whether it's additional imagery that's not in the piece that reporters can reference, like I mentioned with stock imagery. I also like to have kind of like different press releases to use. And this is not to be put out on a wire or anything like that, but press releases. And I think when I was at Distilled, I was always like anti-press release. I know a few clients would request them and they'd put them out on a wire. And I'd be like, oh, it's a waste of my time. But then I started to realize that they're actually really useful for journalists to reference when they're writing the story. It's all about making their lives easier. And it already includes like commentary from any experts that we've interviewed for the piece. In the instance of the piece that I just talked about with commuting times, it made sense for our client to include commentary in the press release because they are authoritative in that space. Like they know about traffic trends. And it made sense to include somebody from internally from that client and that company in the press release. But you could also include external quotes too, as long as you have permission. So press releases, additional imagery assets, and headlines all help in making sure the launch is successful.
Nice. How do you typically send the press release these days? Is it only if requested? Is it in the footer of the email? Is it attached? How do you do it?
If I have a relationship with a reporter or a journalist and I know they're very likely to be interested in the story, I will include it beneath the email body. But if it's somebody that I've never reached out to before, I won't send the press release right away. I'll typically mention it in the body of the email and say, if you'd like to see a press release, let me know, and then send it if they do request it. Or sometimes if I'm very sure that they are interested in the piece, and there are different ways that I measure that. Sometimes it's like just seeing what they write about and knowing that this is a perfect fit and that this is like likely a story that they're going to want to cover because I did my research on their beat. Another way I judge that is if like I see the email being open numerous times, I do use a tool for that. I love Mixmax to see, you know, see who's opening my emails. And if I see that happening, then I will send them the press release beneath the body of the the email saying like, here's a press release that you're welcome to pull from.
Nice. Yeah. What's the thinking behind not sending it to someone you don't really know?
I just don't want to overwhelm them with a bunch of information if they haven't gotten back to me initially. And then like when I follow up, I try to think of other ways to add value beyond the press release. So whether that's offering up an interview with any experts related to the topic, whether that's asking them if they had any questions, that's a way to offer value that's really simple. I think sometimes sending the press release their way in the follow-up, and if they open the email and see all of this information in my press releases, they can be pretty lengthy because I'm not putting them out on a wire, so I'm not worried about word count. They can be pretty lengthy. So I try not to do that just for the sake of not overwhelming somebody.
Nice. Yeah, I'm curious about that follow-up. Not just, you know, not just saying, hey, did you see this? But maybe just having a reason, even if it's a small reason, to get in touch. So you said you could offer up an interview with someone or just ask if they've got any questions. Are there any other ways you can that are useful to follow up?
Yeah. So another reason why I like to have those Dropbox folder of images that they're able to use is like, that's another way to follow up and provide value, saying, hey, we have these images that you're welcome to use as well and embed directly in your article. That's a reason to follow up with somebody and not necessarily like, hey, did you see my email? Also, if you're going after top tier publications, another interesting experiment that I sometimes try is saving some of that imagery as an exclusive, but that only works if obviously it's not stock imagery. There's an example that you and I worked on a long time ago that I'm thinking of called The View from Here.
Oh, yeah.
That I think is a really good example of this. So do you want to give an overview of that piece so I don't butcher it?
No, you go for it. It'd be nice to hear it from your perspective.
So what we did, well, we created it for a company who sells motorized blinds. And the whole idea was to showcase the views from homes all over the world. And it was user-generated content, basically, because we sourced these photos from people who lived all over in these areas that we were highlighting. I don't think there was like necessarily a rhyme or reason to the places that we chose. I think it depended upon the quality of the photos and the stories that they shared as well. So people also had to submit how their view makes them feel. And that provided just an interesting perspective. We had submissions from places I had never heard of. And it was just so interesting and a real human interest piece that people had sad and uplifting stories to share. But anywho, that was the gist of the piece. What we did was we didn't include all of the submissions because we did get a lot, but we did hold some as exclusives. So if an outlet responded to me with interest and say it was like a top tier lifestyle place like Bustle off the top of my head, because I think that actually happened, I said, I'm glad to hear you're interested. Also, if you wanted to share photos that we didn't include, here are a few options. And that is a way of tying in exclusivity, right? And a way of providing them with content that is fresh. And they still had to give credit to the person, the company who created it. So that's another way to provide value. But again, that's thinking in the production phase to remember to save that imagery and set that aside for exclusive purposes.
Nice. I didn't realize we did that. That's really interesting. Yeah, that you mentioned about the whether there was rhyme or reason to where we got, where they came from. It was really just about where they applied from. You know, we put it out as a global platform and it really just depended where people applied from. But there was about 30 or more countries involved. Funnily enough, this one was one that surprised me. Like, obviously, we thought it was a decent idea, but I'm just looking it up just now. And it got covered on Travel Channel, USA Today, Daily Mail, Stylish, Trend Hunter, Travel and Leisure, The Atlantic, Telegraph, HuffPo, Refinery29, Fast Company, Washington Post. That's probably the one of the pieces that's got the most top-tier coverage I've ever been involved in. You know, it was for essentially a kind of a photo story where we asked people around the world to submit photos. I think a key to it was asking them what they think and what they feel when they look out their window. Some of the stories we got back there were really quite touching. It was quite surprising. Mm-hmm. There's one that always sticks in my memory about a young girl. There was her view looked onto another building and it had a light on. And she said, "There's a reason I chose this room when I moved into this house. And that is because this room looks onto my uncle's house. And when I look at it at night and I see his lights on, I know he's looking out for me." I was like, oh.
That's so sweet. I do remember that.
Yeah.
I think you're so right. It had that emotional aspect to it and that human interest piece that made you realize like the world is actually a smaller place than you think.
Hmm. So I have a bit of a framework about what I think makes ideas work and things. But, you know, most of the ideas I usually get involved with are usually quite data-led. And this piece isn't really data-led. I mean, some people argue if you take like a really broad definition of data, then photos are data. But I think most of us don't think like that. If there's no spreadsheet of numbers, it's not data to most of us. How do you kind of assess, like, what is it that makes a journalist want to write about that type of story, do you think?
Yeah, it's always a gamble. When we would approach photo series pieces, I'd always tell my clients this is us taking a bet because a lot of outlets do have their own photo journalists that do this work as well. It's really got to be interesting. I don't know a better way to describe that right now. And it helps too if you can tie it into a timely event is something that I think we kind of realized as well. Another photo series piece that we had success with, we realized that I don't think it translated across like different topics, but I think with photo series pieces, you have to do your research and make sure it hasn't been done before because then you might look like you're copying. And that's too close. Like, yes, you can do that with data, especially if it's like new data or new information, but you don't want to copy a photojournalist's work because it's just pure replication, right?
Yeah, you've made me think about it. I guess in a way, it does still reveal something new. Maybe it's not something that's statistically relevant or something like that, but it is still revealing a sort of human insight. And also, I think I'd think about these maybe, now that you've put it that way, similar to the way I think about competitions. I mean, I don't really run competitions these days, but, you know, sometimes I'm asked about them. And actually, I know of somebody that got one to work reasonably well recently. In fact, it's a good example for the point I want to make. A competition needs to have something, just like a story, something intriguing and new about the angle.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people focus on the prize, but honestly, just giving away a prize is not really a news story. But they did during lockdown for a company that sells, it was the guys at Era did a thing for a company that sells home bar equipment and bar games. They asked for people who were missing the pub to send in photos of their home bar setup, and winners would receive a bunch of kit to make their home bar setup even better.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there's a nice angle there and it's very timely, and which made it work.
They're so smart.
Yeah, yeah, they do well. But that's, maybe it's something similar, that there has to be something intriguing about what it is you've asked people to do and what it reveals.
Mm-hmm.
And actually one thing that always surprised me about that piece was that I guess it makes sense, but it got picked up by Travel. I thought of it more as lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
but the journalist put an interesting spin, and maybe you were involved in this, basically about traveling around the world and getting to see the world from a perspective that you don't normally get to see it, which is a really nice spin.
Yeah, definitely focused on that in my pitching, if I can remember correctly. I wish I remembered the wording, but basically I wrote a little poem of a sentence because I tried to make it as like magical and appealing and enticing as I thought the piece really was. And I just wanted the hardest part is getting those reporters to click through to it And for some of those, I remember incorporating two images. I think I actually made it so that they were actually side by side in one image. And I actually broke my rule and I sent pitches to reporters that included images within the body of the email. So not as an attachment, but within the body. I didn't come across any spam filters, which was amazing. And I think that helped sell the piece too when looking at the pitch, incorporating that imagery side by side. Because again, I don't know if we really emphasize this, but that piece had a shot of the view at night and a view during the day. And putting them side by side. And then I would pull out the excerpt, something from the story from that submitted by that person. And I included it as a quote basically and gave credit to, you know, that person, put their name down and where if they were from in the pitch itself to encourage the journalist to actually click through to view the piece. Because that's always the hardest part, especially when it's something like a photo series piece.
I have some experience of working with people who have come from traditional PR and now they're trying to promote stories about a piece of content, which is often what we are trying to do, especially if you're trying to get that link or whatever. And sometimes they sort of struggle to make the jump. And it seems to be me to be such a small jump from promoting a PR story to promoting a story about a piece of content. But there seems to be something that some people struggle to make a shift. Do you understand what I mean? And have you any idea what it is? What is that little switch that needs to click to allow them to do that? What's the difference?
I don't know. You're asking me tough questions.
Because I want to know.
I don't know.
I can give you a bit more on that. Let's say I've made a piece of content, but within the setup, we have to pass it to maybe our traditional PR agency to promote, or maybe someone within the company to promote who has a traditional PR background. If they are successful in getting coverage, they will most often be successful in just getting coverage for the story without the content or the link. And I'm just wondering what it is. I think there's a slight shift about making sure that the asset is a core part of the story. But I'm just curious what that distinction is, because it seems like they have the skills, right? They can get coverage. But what is it that they're missing to make sure that the content and the link remains a part of the story?
I face that problem too. It's a big no-no to request a link back to anything. There are definitely ways that you can be professional about it. And one of my biggest pieces of advice there is, like, if you really feel the need to go to a reporter and ask for a link, don't outright ask for a link. Explain why you'd like for them to link back to it and say something along the lines of, in case your readers would like to view the piece in its entirety, if you could, you know, reference where they could do that, here's the URL. And that's kind of a way to get around that. I mean, I've had to put on my traditional PR hat a lot lately because my clients don't have big budgets to invest in big graphic, you know, visualizations or big data pieces. They're doing really hard work as far as like thinking about how to pitch commentary, how to pitch the brand in a PR. I don't know. This is a hard question, Mark.
If I was to hazard a guess, they extract the story, they pitch the whole story, and then the link to the thing is like a footnote. Be like, we've also created this infographic. So it's not, they don't make it as core to the story and what you're contacting them about.
That's always my focus. In the view from here, I think in the subject line even, I said new photo series. Or then in the body, like I said, I incorporated the actual image, like one of my favorite images from the piece, and turned it into one. So the day view and the night view. And I incorporated the stories from that person, my favorite excerpt from it. In the beginning, I would actually link to it. So I try to link to the pieces straight away because I don't want them to overlook it towards the end. If it's at the end of the email, that might happen. So I just encourage them to look at the full piece by giving them a glimpse of what they might expect to see in the body itself.
Nice. You mentioned previously when you were outreaching to journalists that you might have a relationship with. Mm-hmm. People often ask me like how important it is to have relationships. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a bit of context to that, is that they're worried that they don't have relationships and therefore how are we going to be successful if we don't have them? So maybe you can speak to that in, mm-hmm. in a couple of ways. Obviously it is useful, and how is it useful? But then also you've obviously got a lot of coverage from people that you don't have a relationship with.
I don't let it get to me when I'm pitching content in a new vertical that I might not have any relationships within, you know, because I think as long as you're tailoring your pitch and putting together a pitch that's succinct and showcases exactly what you think that reporter might be interested in, it's totally okay if you don't have a relationship with them. Yes, it is important and very helpful to have relationships with reporters, because in the future, they're going to be more likely to open your email and consider a story from you if they've worked with you in the past and that story did particularly well. It goes a long way, of course. But if you don't have a relationship with a reporter in that vertical or with somebody that you're cold pitching, I don't let it get to me. I just make sure that I do my due diligence, doing my research on that person and tweaking my pitch so that it speaks directly to what they're writing about and what they might be interested in. I think that's a quick way to summarize my thoughts on that.
Nice. And how do you go about building relationships with journalists? Is that purely through providing them good stuff? Or is there anything else you can do?
I think going back to the importance of having a relationship, one thing that I've learned recently from a journalist that we interviewed on We Earn Media, her name was Trey Bodge, and she's an expert on shopping and saving money. She did say that if you have a relationship with a reporter, don't take advantage of it. Always be professional. Always approach the pitch as if you've never spoken to them before. Don't be like, hey girl, I have a new story that you might be interested in. Unless you've worked up that relationship and that's how that person also speaks to you, like in a very casual way, then read the room, I guess, and you'll learn their language, they'll learn yours, but I try to still be professional. Anywho, moving on to your next question, how to build relationships. So it's different with every reporter. For me, when I have my traditional PR hat on and say I'm pitching like not necessarily big data visualizations, but more like commentary for people who need expert sources, I might just like let them know who I'm working with lately and let them know that I'm available whenever they need to reach out to me. But I think what's key when it comes to building relationships is, again, being a resource, letting them know that you're here to help, explaining what it is that you have that might be useful for them. And then I always love to make sure that I'm interacting and sharing their content as well, whether it's on my own LinkedIn page or my Twitter page. I'm not always the best at that, but it goes a long way when you're also able to share their work and it shows them that you're reading what they write about as well. I've seen too, I have started following some journalists and reporters on LinkedIn and Twitter particularly, and even Instagram, and they're constantly posting things about how they're looking to speak to somebody who has expertise in XYZ, or they're just looking for somebody to speak to who's been watching the latest Netflix show. And I can help them by sharing that post or resharing that post with my friends and family, because I might know somebody who can speak to that new trend. Or if it's an expert, I might go and see that on LinkedIn and share it with my followers too. Or if I know somebody who can speak to that, I'll go out of my way, even if they're not a client of mine, even if it's somebody that I haven't like spoken to in ages, I'll reach out to them and say, hey, I know a reporter who's looking to speak to somebody who, for example, like just started selling t-shirts online since the pandemic. That's a very specific example, but I knew a reporter who was looking to speak to owners of t-shirt companies, like stuff like that, e-commerce companies that sell t-shirts, which is really specific, but I happen to know somebody and I hadn't talked to her in a long time, but I reached out and I connected them. And that's just a way to build relationships. It's not like fake. You're actually being useful.
Funny, when you put it like that, that's just like how you would build a relationship normally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't instantly start talking to someone about what you want from them. You just see if you can be helpful and engage with what they're talking about. And yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We're also virtual now too. It kind of makes it easier and less awkward.
Yeah, nice. I think one thing people want when they build a relationship with a journalist, from some of the people I'm training, what they would ideally want is a journalist that they can email whenever they have an idea to find out if they're likely to cover it. But that to me has never really rung true as something you could do very often. That sounds a bit like the taking advantage of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Do you soundboard ideas? I'd be concerned about doing that. I feel like their time is so limited. They're going through their emails looking for stories. Are they really going to respond to a story you haven't even written yet?
I only do that with a handful of folks, and only if I've actually been useful for them too.
Yeah.
So I have my checks and balances, but I definitely wouldn't like cold pitch anybody and ask them if it's a story that they're interested in without having any data or any idea of what that story would look like in the end either.
Nice. I wanted to ask you a little bit then about We Are in Media. You've been running this podcast you've done 3 seasons now, or you're in the third?
Yeah, we're in the third.
Nice. And you've been very kind in telling me a few things that you've learned about actually running a podcast, which have been really helpful. Thank you. I was wondering, what have you learned from PRs or journalists through the podcast?
I've learned that there aren't like fast, hard rules when it comes to working with journalists. They all have their different opinions and their different preferences when it comes to everything, when it comes to pitching, when it comes to what stories they're looking for. And I've started to like not have definite rules and be more open-minded when it comes to ideation as a result, or when it comes to pitching as a result. I used to be like, no, never pitch anyone via Instagram, or like, don't ever drop into someone's DMs and pitch them something. But I've actually been really surprised by how many reporters have said, like, feel free to DM me on Twitter. But also we've had reporters who said, no, please don't do that. So that's been one of my biggest takeaways, is to be more careful about what I'm saying people shouldn't do.
Mm.
One of my biggest learnings is just how important it is to do your research. Every single reporter has griped about being pitched irrelevant content and irrelevant story ideas. We need to be better at targeting who we're reaching out to. Generally, follow-ups, like it seems like reporters are opening emails. Like very, very few have said that they don't open emails. Almost every single one has seemed to be very on top of the emails that they're getting. Every single person has said that follow-ups are helpful, but again, provide value. I don't think it's necessary to follow up more than once, personally. Hmm. A long time ago, I was being not at Distilled, but previously I was being really measured by like my open rates and my response rates. So I would send like 3 follow-ups, and that's such a big no-no. I stopped doing that a long time ago, but I would highly encourage people to try not to follow up more than once, just based off of what we've been learning.
It's interesting, you know, you mentioned the sort of, you didn't think you called it there, the prospecting, but targeting, like making sure you're speaking to the right people, the right stories to the right people. And I find that that is the part that people ask least questions about. They'll ask about how do you write the email and what goes in the subject line and what goes in the press release and when do you follow up and how do you follow up? But I hardly get any questions about making sure you're speaking to the right people in the first place. What do you do to make sure you're targeting the right people?
So before I reach out to somebody, I look at what they've written. And this is actually really helpful advice that we've gotten a lot, is look at what they've written about recently. Don't find something they wrote about in even like a year ago or even 6 months ago. Make sure you look at what they're writing about in the last month, because their beat might have changed. It's likely to be irrelevant if they've written about it 6 months ago, but hadn't touched on that topic since then. So just because they wrote about it 6 months ago, don't assume they're going to be interested in it if they haven't talked about it in the last month or two. So look at what they're writing about recently. I mean, that's the biggest thing, right? Just looking at what they've been writing about recently to make sure it's relevant to what you're pitching.
So are you really going out to find out maybe more online as opposed to in the tools, who's writing about this thing, as opposed to just doing a big dump of data from a tool?
Yeah. So sometimes I do like love tools to figure out what outlets might be available to pitch. Say it's a topic that I'm not necessarily familiar with, Fleetmatic software, for example. Like, I don't know, say I'm going after trucking magazines for truckers. I might use that as a way to find that those outlets that write on that topic, like those trade publications. And then once I find that trade publication, I even go as far as looking at that outlet, finding a reporter who talked about that topic within the last month, and then pitching them. I get a lot of questions from clients on how many emails I send per campaign, and it really depends on the topic at hand. It really depends on how many outlets are relevant to that topic and who's writing about it within the last 1 to 3 months max. Many PRs might say that limits me, but I just find it way more valuable to make sure that I'm targeting the right person. And then spamming and jamming is not going to get you very far.
I mean, funnily enough, I've just been thinking about recently, but how do you even know a topic is worth doing anything on? And I try to find out, you know, if anyone has written much on it in Google News or BuzzSumo in the last year, you know, is this a topic that gets perpetually talked about in some way? Because if not, if there's nothing, then it might not be worth doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right, Brett, this has been amazing. Thank you very much. Everybody should check out We Earn Media. Is there anywhere else you like to point people to follow you or We Earn Media?
I'm semi-active on Twitter, but you can find me on Twitter at Britt_Klontz and then at We Earn Media on Twitter. And yeah, thank you so much. It was fun to be in the hot seat this time around.
You can give me some tips to make me better at the podcast interviewing.
No, you did a great job, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I hope you enjoyed the show. As always, there are show notes over at contenthubble.com/podcast. And if you do want to learn more about creating better content and coming up with content ideas, check out contenthubble.com. There's plenty of resources there that can help you do just that. All right, speak to you soon.